classic rock and roll voice of Roger McGuinn. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. Original member of the Byrds. Playing one of his biggest hits in a solo version that appeared on a CD/DVD combo that came out last year called Stories, Songs, and Friends. I'm playing that version because Roger is coming to town and will probably play it live for you if you go see him on May 8th at the Wildy Theater in Edwardsville. And I am so happy to have him back on the show today. Hi, Roger. How are you?
Hey, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great. There's a documentary that just started playing here in St. Louis called The Wrecking Crew about this amazing group of studio musicians who played in the 60s and 70s in Los Angeles and played on hundreds, if not thousands, of pop and rock and country hits. And I'm dying to see the documentary after having read the book about them. But I remember in the book reading that they were actually the people who played on Mr. Tambourine Man. You did lead, and you played your 12-string Rickenbacker guitar, but the rest of the Byrds weren't in the studio for the hit version of that song. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true, Paul. What happened was, we were like a really young band, and Michael Clark was just learning how to play the drums on cardboard boxes, and so Terry Melcher made the decision to use the Wrecking Crew, which was a loose net to a bunch of studio musicians that Phil Spector and the Beach Boys and Jan and Dean and the Righteous Brothers and almost everybody in L.A. used for their singles to do the instrumental tracks. And I got to play on it because I'd been a studio musician in New York for about 5 years prior to the Byrds. So they let me, and also I had the Rickenbacker Electric 12, which had a distinctive sound. So I was thrilled to be playing with these guys. You know, they were really cool musicians. Hal Blaine, Leon Russell, Larry Nechtel was on bass. We had Jerry Cole and Bill Pittman on guitars, and it was just a great band. And they knocked off Mr. Tambourine Man and The Flip Side, I Knew I'd Want You, in a few takes. And, of course, the other Byrds were all upset because they wanted to be like the Beatles or play on their own tracks. But I have to give you an example. After we did the single and we got a hit with it, all the other Byrds were allowed to play on their own backing tracks, but it took 77 takes to get Turn, Turn, Turn. So you could see why they had the studio time was expensive. I mean, it cut like $1,000 or $2,000 an hour. So you could see why they would want to do that, why the company would want to do that.
In addition to their efficiency in the studio, did they help change the arrangement of the song at all?
A little bit, because the original demo had some kind of military-sounding drums, and Hal Blaine didn't do that. He played more of a rock beat on it, like the Beatles. So, yeah, and the cohesiveness of the Wrecking Crew, those guys were so tight together as a band that, you know, it just made it really creamy and great-sounding. It was a very good decision on Terry Melcher's part to use the Wrecking Crew. And, of course, I understood. David Crosby and Chris Holman and Michael Clark and Gene Clark were upset that they didn't get to play on their own track. But I don't know if Mr. Tambourine Man would have been a hit if they had.
Wow. Is it true that David Crosby didn't even like the song, didn't even want to do it when he first heard Dylan's version?
Yeah, it is true. Jim Dixon had the song for a while. He heard Paul Rothschild, who was a producer on Elektra Records, talking about Dylan, saying, gee, it's a shame Bob can't use that great new song he just wrote because somebody was singing out a tune on the track. And, of course, the way Bob records, he never did overdub. He would just, if something, you know, was wrong, he'd just leave it that way. And so Ramblin' Jack Elliott was singing harmony, and Ramblin' was a little out of tune. So he just kind of left it like that. We got a copy of it, and Jim played it for everybody, and Crosby said, oh, man, I'm folky 2/4 time. I'm not going to play on the radio. And he was right. You know, the radio was playing more rock and roll. So, and then I had to audition for the part. Gene Clark and I auditioned for the lead vocal. And so we both tried it. We both sang it. And Dixon picked me because I put a little bit of John Lennon and a little bit of Bob Dylan into my vocal and tried to get sort of a mix of the two.
And that was essentially the song that kicked off the folk rock movement, right?
Yeah, you know, it's debatable. Some people say Eric Burden and the House of New Orleans did it, or some other, like skiffle songs back in the, before the Beatles were folk rock. But I really think Mr. Tambourine Man had a tremendous impact on the rest of the recording industry, because everybody kind of did a Dylan song, like the Turtles. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon.
Yeah. Roger, if it comes down to you or Lonnie Donegan, I'm giving you the credit.
Okay.
Now, I know that we don't have two of the members of the Byrds anymore, Gene Clark and Michael Clark, no longer with us. But why don't you and Crosby and Hillman get together and do a Byrds reunion tour?
You know, that that subject has come up quite frequently. And the reason being, I'm having too much fun doing what I'm doing, which is kind of a one-man play. And you can hear that on Story Songs and Friends. It's an autobiographical play. It's like a one-man show, like the life of Will Rogers, except it's not about Will Rogers. So I'm just having too much fun doing that. I know we could probably go out and make some people happy and make some money and all that with the Byrds, but I'm not really into it.
And besides, you're making money and you're making people happy.
Yeah, I'm doing that all by myself. So, you know, without the hassle of bringing trucks and buses and everything.
So that's what you'll be doing when you come to the Wildy Theater on May 8th in Edwardsville. How do you pick the songs and stories you're going to do each night? Because you can't possibly do all of them. There are some you probably have to do, but how do you choose them? Does something spark your memory during the day?
Camilla and I work out the set list at lunch, the day of the show. We'll sit down and she's got a notebook of all the shows I've done for the last many, many years. And we know what we've done in certain areas, so we don't want to exactly repeat that set list. And, of course, there are songs, as you say, like Mr. Tambourine Man, Turn, 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 8 Miles High, and Rock and Roll Star, that people do want to hear. They might be disappointed if they didn't hear them. So I'll do them. But what we do differently is structure the set and the stories. And I've got these story modules that I can jump into a different story for the stuff from the Sweetheart of the Rodeo, or I can talk about Rolling Thunder, or I've got all these different stories to tell.
Great. Speaking of folk music and folk rock, is there a group today that's keeping that alive that is really, really popular? I do have one example, and I wonder if it fits, Mumford & Sons.
I was going to say Mumford & Sons. They're not really doing folk rock. What they're doing is their own brand of music, and they're using some traditional instruments like the banjo and so on. So in a way, it's keeping folk music alive, but they're doing their own thing. And there are people who are doing traditional music, pure traditional music, not so much in the United States, but you find them in Scotland and all over Canada and parts of the UK. It's very... very heartening to see.
I just read an article in Rolling Stone with the headline, Mumford Go Electric. They're abandoning the banjo and the acoustic guitar and the stomping kick drum. Does that disappoint you?
Yeah, that's sad to hear. The great thing was that they were playing the traditional instruments, but whatever, you know, they're a band and they can do what they want. It's like, it's like telling Miley Cyrus how to dress or something.
You just did a 17-week tour of Europe. I've been reading Camilla's roadie reports on your blog. When you're over there, do the audiences react differently to certain songs that perhaps Americans didn't react to so positively, or vice versa?
Well, Chestnut Mare was a bigger hit in the UK than it was in the United States. But on the other hand, Turn, Turn, Turn was the number one in the U.S., and it wasn't in the U.K. So, yeah, there are different tastes. When I play in Europe where the primary language is not English, I get different reactions. But nowadays, everybody, you know, all the people who come to the concerts have grown up and taken English in school, so they all speak. Some of them speak better English than we do, you know. So it's not really, the world has become more homogenized because of the internet and satellite TV and everything. Everybody's watching American accents on television, so they all understand. When I tell my story, I used to kind of cut back on the length of the story because they didn't speak so much English, but that's not true anymore. I can tell just the same length story in Germany or the Netherlands as I can in Indiana or Washington State or wherever.
And the people who may not understand the story, they're still going to hear the song, and they know that.
Yeah, but most of the people do understand the story. They're getting pretty, pretty pretty much getting it.
So Camilla wrote that you did 17 weeks, 54 trains, 61 hotels, and two big ships.
Yes. The big ship was the Queen Mary II, and that's our ferry boat. We take that over to England and back.
Why don't you fly?
Well, we do fly. You know, we flew to Shanghai that year, last year, and we flew from Hawaii to San Francisco. We fly, but we don't particularly enjoy flying. And when I take multiple instruments, it's hazardous to the instrument health because I flew back from Paris to New York, and they broke my 12-string acoustic Martin.
Ooh.
And they offer, you know, when you buy a plane ticket, you're basically signing a waiver that they're not responsible for anything more than a couple of $100.
Yeah.
And the guitar was worth much more than that. So it's a liability. You're taking your chances when you fly with musical instruments. Besides, sailing across the ocean is very enjoyable. And so the Queen Mary II is our ferry boat over and back.
And you play on board?
No, I don't play on board. I've done some lectures, and that's really easy. It's like a 45-minute lecture in the morning, and I'm done.
Nice. I'm Paul Harris talking with Roger McGuinn here on the Big 550 KTRS. Roger's going to be bringing his solo show to the Wildy Theater in Edwardsville on May 8th. I just got a text from one of the people at the Wildy Theater. Roger, there are literally 6 tickets left for your show.
That's always good news. We love to sell out. You know, it makes everybody happy. It makes the audience happy, and it makes the promoter happy, and of course it makes us happy because everybody feels good about the whole thing.
I want to ask you about a couple of things that you and I have covered in your previous appearances on my show. The most recent one, I think, was last June. It was right after you had gone to Capitol Hill to testify on behalf of all the musicians like you who had recorded music before 1972, but weren't being paid performance royalties on those songs by Sirius XM and Pandora and Spotify and similar digital audio services. I wonder if there's an update on that.
No, so far we haven't heard any news about that, whether they've modified the copyright law. I don't think they have. But we got some people saying that they sympathize with us in Washington, but there's been no action on it.
And this doesn't just involve you and Mark Farner from Grand Funk Railroad and others. I mean, we're talking about the Beatles, the Stones, Elvis Presley, Motown, early jazz and blues performers, anything before 1972, something to the tune of $60 million in royalties each year.
Yeah.
That you don't get from the versions of those songs that you performed, right?
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of a joke. I mean, you listen to Sirius XM 60s on 6 and they're getting it all for free.
Wow. One of the other things that you and I talked about many times was technology. You were actually one of the first people I knew of who was changing his house to include all sorts of new technology. Some of it was a thing like solar energy, et cetera. Some of it was musical technology that you were adding. And you once told me that it was possible, and this was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, that it had become possible to keep a music career going and sell your music without a record company. Is that still true in light of what we just talked about?
Yeah, it's true for some artists, not for all. I mean, if you're really a new artist and you're good at getting promotion going with viral videos on YouTube or something, you probably could pull it off by yourself. But for other artists, they would need a record company to give them the publicity machine, get them on the talk shows and radio and everything. So it's kind of a toss-up. I'm fine because I have enough name recognition from the Birds and my solo work over the years to be able to self-produce everything and sell it on Amazon.com and make a good living. We have a cottage industry. We have six products that are for sale, and they sell not only to people online, but they sell in stores because the stores are buying them from CDBaby.com, and they put them in stores. So we have international distribution without a record company.
And it's also probably a lot easier now because you can do it all on your Mac.
Exactly. I have a MacBook Pro and Pro Tools, and I got 96 tracks. I mean, that's unthinkable back 20, 30 years ago. Well, I have to tell you the history, but I guess it was 1991 or 1992. Terry Melcher invited me out to California to play on a Beach Boys album, and I said, sure. So I flew out to his house in Carmel, went up to the house and we were hanging out. And I thought we were going to go down the hill to the studio any minute. But no, we went into another room where he had a Macintosh set up with an early version of Pro Tools. And we recorded the whole Beach Boys album on Pro Tools. It was one of the first albums recorded on that software. And that really fired me up. I went, wow, man, I could do this by myself. And over the years, I did get Pro Tools, and now I've got it on, you know, in my studio. It's just a wonderful, liberating thing for artists because you don't have to pay a couple of $1,000 an hour for the studio time anymore.
Roger, I just got an email from a listener named Jane who's been a lifelong fan of yours but has never heard the story of how David Crosby joined the band. Would you mind sharing it?
Well, Gene Clark and I were writing songs at the Troubadour in the front room, a little place called the Folk Den. And Crosby walked in. Now, I'd met David Crosby in 1960 when I was performing with the Limelight, so I knew who he was. He walked in and said, I want to be in your band. And I said, well, we don't really have a band. We're just kind of writing songs here. He said, ah, come on, man. If I can be in your band, I know this guy's got a recording studio we could use for free. And I said, okay, you're in. That was how David got in the band.
What if today he came up to you and said, hey, I've got a MacBook Pro and I've got Pro Tools?
Yeah, that would have done it if we'd known what that was.
You mentioned how radio has played a part in any new band getting some attention. Do you remember the first time you heard a Bird song on the radio?
Yeah, it was in L.A., and it was Mr. Tambourine Man, and we were still broke. I mean, we were just down on the street walking around. We didn't have a car. We're taking buses everywhere. And I remember a car going by on Sunset Boulevard, and Mr. Tambourine Man was blaring out of a speaker. And I went, wow, that's our song.
And did you, and what do you do after the song is over? You just have to all be jumping with joy inside, but then do you go and say, we have to celebrate, or what?
No, there's no celebration until later. I took there's a lag between when you get a hit record and when you make some money off of it. So it was probably about a year before we saw any real money come in. We were getting musicians' union checks from doing the sessions, but that was about it. And Gene Clark got the lion's share of the royalties because he wrote most of the songs. And he went out and bought a sports car, and we were still taking buses. You know, so that created a little bit of tension in the group.
I would think it would. He's got a sports car. I can afford a high five, and that's all.
Yeah, there you go.
That's it. Roger McGuinn is going to be at the Wildy Theater in Edwardsville on May 8th. I'm sure since I said that there were 6 tickets left, there probably aren't any left anymore. But you can go to the Wildy Theater box office website and find out about that and other shows that they have coming up there. I haven't seen you in a long time, and I'm going to be out there, and I'm looking forward to seeing your show in person. And it's always a great pleasure having you on.
Well, thanks, Paul. I do enjoy performing. I have a lot of fun doing these shows, so I'm going to be having fun doing it.
We will all have a great time that night. Thanks, Roger.
Okay, Paul.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Roger McGuinn here on the Big 550 KTRS with Paul Harris.